The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to All About Agatha, the podcast dedicated to reading and ranking every single mystery novel written by the queen of crime, Dame Agatha Christie. I'm Kemper Donovan.
I'm Catherine Brobeck.
And this week we are not covering a novel. We are back with a person who is becoming our quite dear friend because we've been enjoying these short stories so much, Mr. Harley Quinn. And we, of course, will also never forget dear Mr. Satterthwaite as well.
Given I'm excited. I think Mr. Satterthwaite is actually our friend, and Mr. Quinn, as we've discussed, is a weird enigma in the background.
I mean, let's be honest, it's just Mr. Satterthwaite talking to himself.
Right. Yes. So where do we find our friend Mr. Satterthwaite this week? We should note that we're doing a story called The Voice in the Dark, which sounds sinister.
Ooh, very spooky, very on point for the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection. So The Voice in the Dark was first published in the Storyteller magazine in March 1927. And then it would, of course, be part of the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection published in 1930. This is actually one that was also technically published first in the USA on the 4th of December, 1926 in Flynn's Weekly. Agatha Christie disappeared on the 3rd of December, 1926, and that would be the start of her 11-day disappearance. So on the very next day in the USA in Flynn's Weekly, The Voice in the Dark adds a little extra spook factor to this story.
Intriguing.
Intriguing. All right, Catherine Brobeck, could you tell us a little bit about our victim?
Well, let's hold this thought. That's my first point. Let's hold this thought about who the victims are in this story. But there's one obvious victim, and it's Miss Marjorie Gale, who's a young, I guess, heiress-to-be, who keeps hearing these threatening voices in the dark, naturally, in her house in the English countryside. And, you know, she thinks she's hallucinating, except she really actually doesn't think that. She really thinks there's a voice coming from somewhere.
Interesting that you said heiress-to-be, by the way. It just made me think this, sorry, this is a little bit of a tangent, but is an heiress one who has already inherited or one who is about to inherit or both?
I think it
I'm honestly not sure.
You know,
like, I feel like I should know that.
It's definitely somebody who has inherited.
Right.
And I think that in the context of heir, so if heiress is the feminine of heir, an heir is your heir. So if I am a wealthy, you know, business magnet and have a vast amount of money to leave to my heir, that is an heir, that is somebody to be, right? So I suppose it's both cases.
And you know what, Catherine Brobeck, you have just been confirmed by Merriam-Webster.
Really?
No less vaunted.
I like being our personal dictionary, I guess.
Yeah, one who receives property from an ancestor, one who is entitled to inherit property. So it's both. All right. Well, heiress Miss Marjorie Gale as our victim, and perhaps we will come across other victims as well as we get into this story. Let's talk about some suspects here, because we do have a slight puzzle mystery here, I would argue. There's very, very slight. There's one Christie-ish clue that I think we can mine from this story. So that always excites me, especially in a Harley Quinn, because we don't always get a puzzle mystery, but sometimes we do. And I suppose our first suspect would be ghosts.
One never knows. We did touch upon ghosts in our last Mr. Quinn.
Absolutely. You never know, especially within the Mr. Quinn-verse, the Harley Quinn-verse. And it seems that the house Miss Marjorie Gale lives in the English countryside is haunted, hence the titular voice in the dark. You know, it is noted that this house is a relatively new, hideous Victorian thing where no one seems to have died tragically for now. But even so, perhaps there is a haunting here.
Perhaps so. And then suspect number two is Miss Marjorie Gale herself, because she could obviously just be going crazy.
That is a definite possibility. Legitimate possibility. Yeah. Next up, we have Lady Barbara Stranley, who is Marjorie's glamorous baroness of a mother, who has been married many times and seems to live a rather high-flying lifestyle. More on that in a bit. And she is disappointed in her frumpy daughter, doesn't really seem to like her very much. Who knows? Perhaps she has some ulterior motives of her own in torturing her poor daughter.
Then we have Rolly Vavasour, it's a grand name, who is the next heir to the fortune and the title should Lady Stranley and Marjorie die.
Next up, we've got Mrs. Casson, who is a well-meaning family friend and a huge pusher.
Because I'm a pusher. I push people.
Of spiritualists to the point where Marjorie is very uncomfortable with it and just wants her to stop with the mediums and the fortune tellers and the tarot readers, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Speaking of,
we have Mrs. Lloyd, who is the medium that Mrs. Casson brings down to the house.
Right, she's the medium du jour.
Right.
And then finally, we have Mrs. Clayton, who is Marjorie's elderly maid and who is so elderly that she was Marjorie's mother's maid before that. So she used to be maid to Lady Barbara.
So the world as it appears to be, Mr. Satterthwaite is, guess what, Kemper? He's on vacation.
Could he be, abroad, perhaps?
when is he not? This time he is in Cannes, which is more his usual speed than some mysterious Spanish island. It's more part of his circuit. And
although, sorry to interrupt, but it was one thing that I noted in this story. There's a reference made to the last time that Mr. Satterthwaite and Harley Quinn met. And they specifically say that it was in Corsica, which is interesting because we, of course, assumed that the locale was where Christie herself had been when she wrote the story, since it's so specifically set there. But it is fictionally supposed to have been in Corsica, not the Canary Islands.
Well, unless we just missed one of their meetings.
It's possible, but they even make reference to the fact that Mr. Quinn, quote, left very suddenly that day.
I mean, Mr. Satterthwaite doesn't have a whole lot of a reaction that you think that he might have if the events of The Man from the Sea had happened just before this.
Right. This is the dude who, jumped off a cliff.
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Satterthwaite, you think maybe would have had a slightly different reaction, but...
Well, you know what? Mr. Satterthwaite might be rocking in the corner of a train carriage talking to himself while that conversation is going on. So
definitely a possibility that we will leave open. But for now, when he's not talking to himself in a corner, he's talking to Lady Stranley, who is for once not a duchess, alas. Mm-hmm. She's a baroness, which is like, oh, Satterthwaite, like what a step down.
Baroness, just a foul taste in my mouth.
Although, I can't say the Baroness without thinking of The Sound of Music.
Champagne, darling. I feel like celebrating. Cheers.
Anytime.
Oh, the poor Baroness.
Oh, the Baroness. Anyway, he's known this Baroness for 40 years since they were young, and she was known by her maiden name, Barbara Baron. And he knew both Barbara and her sister Beatrice, as well as their pretty slip of a maid, Alice, who Satterthwaite had once snuck a kiss from, which is like either sexual harassment or it's kind of sweet.
Yeah, I know. I can't really imagine Mr. Satterthwaite as a young man, but he absolutely gets a little nostalgic remembering it. So Lady Stranley tells Satterthwaite a story about her frumpy boar of a daughter, Marjorie, who may be going insane because back in their house in England, Marjorie has been hearing voices and she's been encouraged to seek a spiritualist for assistance. And Lady Stranley, in her importunate manner, just puts this on Mr. Satterthwaite and says she would very much appreciate it if when Mr. Satterthwaite returned to England, he looked in on Marjorie, since Mr. Satterthwaite knows all the right people. And Mr. Satterthwaite kind of plumes himself off of this comment. Right. And he's like, well, that is true. I do know all the right people, including the best spiritualists, if one has
Shouldn't
to go down that
route. Right.
Yeah. By the way, that conversation is cut short when Lady Stranley's latest squeeze,
Bimbo,
i.e. boyfriend, comes, who is a comely tennis pro, which reminded me of Raymond Starr from The Body in the Library, except that his name is Bimbo.
Yeah, Bimbo.
I thought that was really interesting.
I just, and Mr. Satterthwaite thinks, well, maybe Bimbo could be number five.
And Lady Stranley also makes a really amusing reference to, I think, her first husband, or at least one of her earlier husbands, where she had to apply for what seems to be one of those conjugal desertion things when you don't actually consummate
your marriage.
The marriage. So it's like, that's interesting. I'm not sure what was going on with Rudolph. Anywho,
I know it seems moving like right maybe along. We could have delved in a little deeper to Lady Stranley's previous husbands, because it seems like there was some intrigue there.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like there's a really dishy, you know, Romana Clay to write about her exploits.
I also like that she looks, you know, like barely into her 20s, despite the fact that she's 60, because she spent so much money on all of the beauty shops of Europe.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, there is a definite focus on the Baroness's youthful appearance. Perhaps that is a clue. We shall see in a little bit.
So on the train back to England, Satterthwaite runs into guess who?
Who, Catherine?
Mr. Quinn.
What?
And, yeah, Mr. Quinn.
I can't believe it.
I know. They both agree that they're going to meet in the dining car, which, and this is the part that I really just appreciated. Mr. Satterthwaite always goes for the early bird special. They don't call it that, but it's the first seating. The first seating. And it's because you can trust that the food won't have turned, I guess.
Yeah. I just have to point out, because I love the moment when Mr. Quinn appears in these stories, because Christy just can't help herself. He appears specifically when the conductor of the train is pointing out to Mr. Satterthwaite an accident that had happened on the line a few years mm-hmm. previously. And as the conductor finishes telling the story of this sad tale, who should just appear over the conductor's shoulder but Mr. Quinn? It's as if he sprung up from the site of a past disastrous, tragic
occurrence. I'm sure you also appreciated that at dinner, they, of course, order a bottle of red wine through which the light can shine.
I may or may not have underlined the following sentence. The bottle was between him and the light, but for a minute or two, a red glow enveloped his person.
Yeah, that seems about right. So, Poor Mr. Quinn, you know, you do kind of have to wonder if Mr. Quinn is real, because he really puts up with a lot of long-winded stories from Satterthwaite. In this case, in particular, because Satterthwaite proceeds to sort of delight in telling him basically the entire biography of Lady Stranley, who, again, Mr. Quinn has never met. What is her story, Kemper?
Lady Stranley, you see, grew up rather impoverished. Her uncle was the Baron. She was not within the direct line to inherit this title. Interestingly, it is a very old title, one of the few that can descend in the female line,
right.
Mr. Satterthwaite tells Mr. Quinn. But even so, it's not like her father was the Baron and she was his only daughter. She was a niece, a little bit like Her Majesty herself, Queen Elizabeth, upon her birth. It wasn't really ever thought she would become queen, but in a much smaller, more modest way, Barbara Baron was not born to be Baroness, but later when she was traveling with her whole family on the ship Euralia near New Zealand, it sank, drowning a huge number of passengers. And Barbara, Lady Stranley now, survived, but her older sister Beatrice went down with the ship, unfortunately. And when Barbara's uncle died, and I believe even a nephew, she got very lucky that there was an uncle and I think at least another male heir or two between her and the uncle who died. She inherited the title
and the money
and you know, all the money and everything else. She went on to marry four times, to have one daughter, and to enjoy this title for quite a long time. It has been many, many decades. And Mr. Satterthwaite is going to perform the commission he has been asked to perform, because he is, after all, a gentleman and he likes holding on to his high-flying friends. And he asks Mr. Quinn to come with him to Abbot's Mead, which is where Marjorie is living and apparently hearing this voice in the dark. But Mr. Quinn says he has other business. Intriguing. But that he'll be nearby at, where, Catherine? Where
is he going to be? The Bells and Motley.
What?
The Bells and Motley.
The Bells in Motley, I believe that we had an entire Mr. Quinn story take place there. The titular at the Bells in Motley.
Conveniently titled so that we would remember.
Yeah, with a little like quotation mark, which again is used here. Like every time that in name is used, it has to be in quotation marks. I don't understand why. It's a little annoying.
It's a little odd, but I mean, I guess we remember it, right?
Yep. Bells and Motley, again, very appropriate for Harlequin.
Well, and he'd love it if Satterthwaite would stop by.
Absolutely. So what happens next?
Satterthwaite goes to Abbott's Mead, which is this Victorian house, and he meets Marjorie, who is wearing a plaster on her neck because the night before she was having yet another one of these spooky dreams. And the voice was telling her, give back what is not yours. And she dreamt that that voice was pushing a spike to her neck, except she woke up and there was, in fact, a spike being pressed against her neck. And so she started screaming, and her maid, Clayton, rushes in only to apparently feel something rush by her. So she, too, insists that Marjorie isn't hallucinating this, and there's some sort of bad energy at work in the house.
Very, very spooky. Mm-hmm. In the meanwhile, the Baroness has received a letter from Marjorie along with a box of chocolates, which Marjorie did not send and has ended up with a bout of food poisoning in Cannes. So Mr. Satterthwaite, deductive genius that he is, right, puts those two points together in the letter because apparently no one else was going to and says, perhaps someone poisoned her with a box of chocolates. Maybe he too had read the chocolate box within the Poirot
Perhaps the chocolates were filled with a lot of crunchy pills.
Since we know now that Agatha Christie, the author, can be enjoyed within works created by Agatha Christie, I think there's no reason to think that Mr. Satterthwaite couldn't be an avid reader of Poirot short stories.
It's a possibility. You never know. So at this point, Rowley, who is Marjorie's cousin of some variety, he shows up dragging Mrs. Casson and her medium, Mrs. Lloyd, for a seance. At the seance, it's confirmed immediately that there's bad energy, and Mrs. Lloyd is channeling something in the house. Satterthwaite, of course, is cynical about this, so he tests the medium, asking about an incident, because it seems as though it might be Beatrice who is being channeled. And so he asks about this incident when they were young, where Beatrice made fun of a young man, Mr. Botticelli, who had a boating mishap, and Beatrice started mocking him, possibly to his face, unclear, but she just only would refer to him as Boats Upsetty.
And so clever.
Yes. And so it's something that only Mr. Satterthwaite, the Baron sisters, and Alice would have known.
Right. Yeah. The whole seance sequence is interesting, especially because before we even get to Beatrice being channeled, there was the medium's control, which is apparently a presence that then controls the spirits.
Yeah, I was trying to overlook that bit, Kemper.
Yeah, I think it's important to note it that this medium's control presence, so it's like the presence that then channels the spirits for the medium, is a, quote, Red Indian called Cherokee. And here is Cherokee's dialogue. Indian brave says you good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Someone here very anxious speak. Someone here very anxious give message to young lady. I go now. The spirit say what she come to say.
Gosh.
Cringe.
Yeah, it's really not good.
Not great. But anywho, it does seem as if Beatrice has been successfully channeled because, you know, Mr. Satterthwaite tested the medium and she passed the test with flying colors because she knew the joke. So that is curious.
Right.
It is soon revealed after that the Baroness is headed back to Abbott's Mead. So Mr. Satterthwaite decides to return to London to let Marjorie deal with her mother on her own. Her commission was, in my absence, can you help me out? So if she's coming back, he doesn't need to be there too. Particularly, he knows that the fur is going to fly because Marjorie is planning on marrying this curate who does not sound at all like the polished, suave kind of suitor.
But Kemper, you should see him on a horse.
Marjorie is very, very well, because Marjorie is really into horses.
Oh, she's really into horses. Yeah.
And you know, I don't even remember the characters' names, but I'm going to make a really random reference all the way back to Death in the Clouds, where there were two horse-obsessed characters as well, and they ended up together in the end. I feel like in Christie, people who are obsessed with horses just have to end up together, because it's such an overwhelming obsession, apparently.
Well, I suppose if you really liked riding around the countryside all day, it would be very hard if your mate in life only liked being in the city, like driving roadsters.
Right. I guess it is an all-consuming sort of passion and one that creates a lifestyle around it. So fair enough. So Mr. Satterthwaite leaves. You get the feeling he's kind of like, yeah, I'm going to extricate myself from this mess.
Right.
Because this is not my problem. And once back in London, however, Mr. Satterthwaite reads the paper to find the lurid headline, Baroness Dies in Her Bath. What happened, Catherine?
Well, he immediately heads back south. But instead of going to Abbotsmead, he goes to the Bells of Motley to seek out Mr. Quinn. Because what he's trying to do is he's trying to convince Mr. Quinn to go with him to the house. But, and this is sort of important, Mr. Quinn insists that he doesn't know these people, but Satterthwaite has known these people for 40 years. Thus, it should be Satterthwaite who goes to see the people who he knows. Seems a little bit stupid to emphasize that, but Mr. Quinn, as usual, has point. So yeah, Satterthwaite is like, ugh, fine. And he returns to the house by himself, only to find Marjorie, now freaked out, making a will. Because she fears terribly for her life. Her mother, the theory is that her mother fell asleep and then slipped under the water. But everybody thinks, you know, like the ghosts or whoever else murdered her.
Yeah.
So Marjorie's paranoid. And what she also wants is that she wants the bulk of her inheritance to go to her fiancé, Noel, the curate, and not her shady cousin, Rolly, who she does not like. And so this is why she is making this will. And so she asks Satterthwaite to be a witness. And Satterthwaite says to her, well, no, this is not how this works. You need to sign the will in front of two witnesses, and then they sign it so that there are three people in the room. That's how you sign a will. And she kind of just like poo-poos it, and he's like, fine, whatever, and goes to sign the will and looks above at Clayton. And to be clear, Clayton, who's the lady's maid, we've only ever heard referred to as Clayton in the story.
Which is in keeping with how ladies' maids are referred to, just by their last name.
Correct. Obviously, there has to be a full name as witness to the will. And so when Satterthwaite goes to sign, he looks at the signature and the name says Alice Clayton. And Mr. Satterthwaite is so dumbstruck that he kind of has a hard time even functioning for a minute. Why, Kemper?
Well, this is where we get into the world as it actually is and what is happening here. Mr. Satterthwaite immediately thinks of Clayton's brown eyes. And then he remembers back to his stolen kisses with Alice, the maid, a beautiful blue-eyed slip of a thing, because up until this point, he hadn't put together that Alice Clayton is at least holding herself out to be the same maid, Alice, who he knew those many moons ago. We're given the information that Clayton used to be Marjorie's mother's lady's maid.
Right.
But that was never quite connected to the slip of a thing made of the two young women, who also presumably would have been a lady's maid, but also very young and referred to by as Alice by mistresses as young as Barbara and Beatrice. And the connection was just never made by Mr. Satterthwaite. So dun, dun, dun. What that means is that Alice, the maid with her blue eyes, cannot be the same person as Alice Clayton, the maid with her dull brown eyes. And I would argue that the overarching clue there is that this is a story in which we are told something supernatural is happening. And in Christie, most of the time, what we do when we are confronted with something supernatural is to figure out the Occam's razor solution, right? Well, what is the simplest, rational, non-supernatural solution to this problem? We're told that Marjorie hears a voice in the dark when Clayton is sleeping in the room with her. Well, perhaps Clayton was the one whispering to her in the dark and then saying, well, I didn't hear anything.
Right.
We're told that Clayton is the one rushing in after Marjorie had something held to her neck. Well, perhaps Clayton was just in the room because she was the one holding something to her neck. These are simple explanations. And the most interesting one, which we'll get to in a moment, has to do with that seance.
Right. And, you know, there's another clue here. After Marjorie's attacked, Clayton says as an aside to Mr. Satterthwaite, oh, well, you know, she has a plaster in her neck, but it won't scar. It won't be as bad as my scar. And she has a scar on her forehead because, of course, she's been the lady's maid to the family. And she was also on the Euralia, which she survived along with Barbara, but she got this scar on her forehead in the sinking. So we know that earlier on in the story, which you would think that wouldn't matter, but guess what? It does matter, because what is the solution here? If we have somebody named Alice who doesn't look like the Alice that Satterthwaite knew, including doesn't have the right eye color, I think we could make the assumption, as we just did, that it's not the same person. So what happened to Alice? There's an easy...
Alice must have gone down in the ship.
Yeah, must have. So who else was with them who might have had brown eyes? Yeah.
Beatrice.
There's Beatrice. There's the slightly older sister who got apparently conked so hard over the noggin, she was brain damaged or had terrible amnesia, at which point Barbara, opportunist that she was up until I guess she was offed, Barbara decided to tell her that her name was Alice and that she was her maid. And then because all of Barbara's family was gone, Barbara ends up inheriting the fortune from their uncle as the only surviving immediate family member. So basically, her slightly older sister has been working as first her maid and then her daughter's maid for the past 40 years.
I mean, that's pretty cruel.
Right.
You know what she did?
What did she do?
She pulled a whatever happened to Baby Jane.
I made you waste your whole life thinking you'd crippled me. Please stop. You didn't do it, Jane. I did it myself. Don't you understand? I crippled myself.
Yeah, she's right? Basically what we have is a case of gaslighting.
Yeah, major, major untruthfulness here going on between sisters over decades, resulting in a super toxic relationship and the death of both of them.
Well, ultimately. I mean, the thing is, there is some lack of clarity even in the ending here, because what Satterthwaite suggests to Marjorie is that only recently has something come unstuck in Clayton / Beatrice's head. And while she doesn't seem to entirely remember why or who she actually is, she does know she's not been treated in any way that wasn't cruel. And so she decides to torture Marjorie, sends the poison chocolates to Barbara. Then when Barbara comes home, she drowns her in the bathtub. It is a little unclear that she is fully aware in any way of who she is or why she's doing it.
Yeah, it's weird. And even more problematic then is that seance, because the idea is that the medium knew the in-joke between Beatrice and Barbara because Clayton, the maid, who was actually Beatrice, had somehow communicated that to the medium in her muddled way. And I suppose the medium, being the charlatan that she probably was, since again, this is a Christie story, was getting whatever information she could to seem like a legitimate spiritualist. That seems to be the implication to me. I don't really see another. It's a little awkward, though. I don't see another way to interpret it. Do you?
No, unless you believe that she's actually a medium and what she's channeling is Alice.
That she's channeling Alice the maid. But then, I mean, Alice the maid certainly did a terrible job of clearing things up during that session.
I know. Well, she does fade away very quickly. It's noted. Mrs. Cassin says, oh, we're losing her.
Right, because she was channeling someone who wasn't even dead. I mean, that person was in the room. Maybe you could argue that Beatrice's psyche was so
damaged,
turbulent.
Yeah,
damaged and turbulent within the room, that's what the psychic was picking up on. So that even though she was channeling a live person's nonsense, that's just what came through. That's all a little bit unclear. And not that it bothers me too much, but what it means is that the superstitious hoo-ha was just not really functioning the way that it was supposed to. And probably, I think that my interpretation would probably be the one that Christie would stick to, because usually these superstitious sequences are shown up to be just complete nonsense.
Right.
But it is unclear.
Very unclear.
And that's probably appropriate for a Mr. Quinn story, because this is the rare pocket of the Christieverse where supernatural happenings and superstitions are allowed, I think, to, if not flourish, at least exist.
Right. And so, I mean, just to put a cap on this, Satterthwaite and Marjorie go to confront Beatrice / Clayton, but she's already dead from a heart attack, and that's the end.
Very convenient, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it is.
It's another Christie closer of a short story where to me it feels like, oh boy, this story is already long enough for the space that the newspaper told me they have. So I got to wrap this one up.
I know. So it's just like, oh, not enough word count left. So she dead.
She dead. The end. Yeah. I mentioned that the youth of Lady Stranley or of the Baroness being a little bit of a clue. Because there is the point made that it's so unbelievable that the Baroness and Clayton could actually be sisters who aren't that far apart in age, since one looks so young and the other looks so old. But that is believable given the different lives that they've had. The Baroness has been pampered and paid attention to her appearance for decades versus her poor, befuddled sister who's been slaving away as a maid and half crazed. So I liked that intrigue there and that slight wrinkle to the mystery.
The problem with the story is that there's like a lot of, there's the seance mumbo jumbo where you have a hard time telling how much of it you're supposed to take seriously. There is Mr. Quinn having a very limited role in this.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that there's like this repeated point made about how close he is, but you know, he doesn't really seem to have a role in this. And then there's also the psychology, psychiatry side of stuff. What actually happened to Beatrice? How much is she cognizant of what's going on? We don't really get clarity on any of those things.
Right, because she doesn't, I mean, her plan doesn't really even make sense. Why is she whispering things to Marjorie in the dark?
When she's just going to kill Marjorie.
Right, when she's, I mean, she's putting her on her guard when that's the last thing she should be doing. She should first be killing her sister and then killing Marjorie. But then that's not even really necessarily solving her problem. Because
who would recognize her? Who would identify that she was in fact the sister who's been presumed drowned for 40 years?
Right, so I mean, the muddle of psychiatry, I think you could argue works in the story's favor because she doesn't have a strong motivation to act the way she is, but she's just damaged. So she's acting
out. Well, I mean, and, right. And Satterthwaite, that's why Satterthwaite essentially is saying, well, something has just shaken loose, basically. And she knows that something happened, but there's not really any other there.
So I guess she got what was coming to her when she was drowned in the bathtub by her sister.
All this time we could have been friends.
I guess, although, again, we don't even know that Beatrice knows that she was Barbara's sister.
We just know that she was mad.
Yeah, we just know that she was, like, mad.
In both senses of the word.
Yes, correct, yeah. Correct. Yeah, so...
I don't know. I didn't mind this one, though. I have some affection for this Mr. Quinn story.
I just did not entirely understand. This is, like, a really stupid complaint to have, given his role in other stories, but I really didn't understand Mr. Quinn's presence in it other than to force Satterthwaite to the conclusion that he had to be the one to go back because he was the one who knew the people. And that's true.
I mean, Mr. Quinn acts as a catalyst, right? So it's a small role. It's a small catalyzing role here, but it's something. It is funny that in that moment when Mr. Quinn asks Mr. Satterthwaite, oh, what's happening, when he goes finally to Bells and Motley and he's really upset, and Mr. Satterthwaite says, I thought it was really funny. He says, you know, I am perfectly certain that you know, but I will tell you. Like, you know, he looks at him reproachfully. It's like Mr. Satterthwaite knows that Mr. Quinn is essentially just forcing Mr. Satterthwaite to talk it out as if he's talking to himself, which again, he probably is. He's probably in the Bells and Motley and that innkeeper's daughter or whatever, who was finally going to get married to her paramour, right, at the end, is looking at him like, can we get him out of here? This is scary.
Sir, you've been overserved.
Your limo driver is here. It's fine.
No,
you're not driving.
His Rolls Royce driver, because when he has to rush down to the Bells and Motley, he just walks outside his door and his like huge Rolls Royce is there driving as fast as it can down to the Bells and Motley.
How dare I?
I would. Yeah, I know. I would not mind if when I called for an Uber, I opened the door and it was a giant Rolls Royce.
Well, I think that is all we have for The Voice in the Dark. As always, no adaptation, sadly. When is The Mysterious Mr. Quinn going to be adapted, Catherine?
It's a real tragedy.
Could someone call Sarah Phelps?
Yeah, demand that she should take an interest in Mr. Satterthwaite. They could do some interesting visuals with Mr. Quinn. I think that, you know, there's a giant eerie factor. Come on, BBC.
Explore the nuances of the Quinn-Satterthwaite relationship.
I know.
You know, I'm not joking. I mean, this you could make this cinematic. I'm just saying.
We've said this about a lot of the Mr. Quinn stories. I think a lot of them are really interesting and something especially visually interesting could be done with a lot of them.
Agreed. I think that is a perfect ending point for this episode. Join us next time when we will be covering a novel, and I'd like Catherine to tell us what that novel is.
Kemper is just trying to egg me on so that I fangirl and embarrass myself, but look at my even keel, Kemper. Next week for Valentine's Day, we are doing a story that is ultimately, I think, about what we do for the people who we love. And it is Five Little Pigs, which, as longtime listeners know, I might have some deep-seated affection for. So let's see how this goes, and we will see you all back here on Valentine's Day.
Five Little Pigs is your Valentine.
Thank you, Kemper.
The novel itself. All right. Very excited for that. And in the meantime, we would love to hear from you. Feel free to email us at allaboutthedame@gmail.com or find us on our various social media platforms via Twitter. We're at All About The Dame. Catherine is at Brobcat. On Facebook, our Facebook page is All About Agatha. And our Instagram handle is at All About Agatha. And we really appreciate the ratings and reviews we've gotten thus far. And we encourage listeners to continue to leave them for us, especially since it helps other people find the podcast. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.